Hello, everyone. This is Christopher Coleman. And a slight correction, you'll hear that this is episode 123 in the introduction. It's actually episode 124. You'll also hear a few dropouts in my recording specifically. And so I apologize for that. What's up, podcast people and soundtrack geniuses around the world? You're listening to The Soundcast, the official podcast of TrackSounds.com. And on this podcast, we discuss all things film, television, and video game music. I am Christopher Coleman, and joining me for this episode is...
Kristen Romanelli of Film Score Monthly Online.
And I'm Dean Walker, composer in parentheses.
Today is Sunday, December 2nd, 2018, and this is episode 123 of The Soundcast, where we review Henry Jackman's original score for Ralph Breaks the Internet.
I missed your reading of the days and episodes.
Well, I didn't have a voice.
Yes, well, you did. It was just someone else's voice.
It eventually became no voice.
Oh, okay. I'm glad you've got your voice back. Not that Dane didn't do a great job of reading that part, but...
Oh, I heard what you were saying. I felt it.
No, you did fine. but we're glad to have you back. You can listen to all episodes of Soundcast at thesoundcast.com, or you can find it pretty much wherever you can find podcasts. Just try it out and see if you find us there. If you don't, let me know, and then we'll put it there. Wherever you do listen, leave us a rating and a review. We're going to play a little, not a review, but some feedback on the show in just a minute. But letting us know what you think of the show really helps us out. I have been reading some of the reviews lately, and they're not all very kind, but they are helpful. You can send us your feedback at soundcast@tracksounds.com, or as you're going to hear, leave a message on our SpeakPipe widget, or hit us up on Twitter at Audio Soundcast or at Track Sounds, or on Facebook. Well, welcome back to you too, Dane. I've already welcomed Kristen back. Hope you guys had a good, healthy Thanksgiving.
I didn't good because your Dallas Cowboys won.
That was just the best. And then we won again last week, which is even better. And Kristen's not saying anything.
I did not have a healthy Thanksgiving.
Oh, you were.
And so... I have Alvin Kamara as a starter on my fantasy team. So this whole thing is just down the drain for me.
Well, no one expected him to get shut down like that, but I was quite happy to see it. He'll be fine next week. Don't worry. Start him next week.
I started him this week.
This past Thursday?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a mistake. Big mistake. Well, we're going to do something we don't do very often, but we've got some listener feedback from someone who left us not one, not two, not three, but four messages, all containing one long message on our SpeakPipe widget from Tanner Greer, and he listened to episode 120, which was one of our Soundcast 6 episodes, and you're going to hear what he has to say about that episode in two parts. We'll let you listen to the first part, and we'll react to it, and then we'll listen to the second part. So here's the first part regarding the Letterboxd, the perfect score story we did in that episode.
Hey, Soundcast folks. My name is Tanner Greer. I've responded to your guys' podcast before, and I had some thoughts based off of some of your conversations in the most recent Soundcast 6. The first one involved the big Letterboxd thread and all the different soundtrack rankings they had on it. And you guys expressed some surprise that Phantom Thread was on the list. I would not put Phantom Thread in my top 20 scores ever, but it really doesn't surprise me. and I think you guys kind of said that, you know, what makes this list is that it's really iconic. I would probably say maybe that this list is full of soundtracks that are super striking. They're the kind of things that average viewer looks at, remembers, and has some kind of emotional effect because of and recalls I don't know, a few days, years, or so on down the line. I would put Phantom Thread in this category. I think Phantom Thread is a really interesting film because it's one of the few films at the current moment that emphasizes the music. It calls attention to the music in a way that is really abnormal for most films. And the way it does that is because if you listen to sound, like if you listen to Phantom Thread without watching it, which is what I originally did, it doesn't seem remarkable at all. But when you watch it in context, it's really, really almost upsetting. At least that's how I felt. Because what you see on the screen is juxtaposed with music that doesn't seem to match at all. And the music is put on a very, very kind of loud track. And this kind of juxtaposition creates maybe this kind of sense of unease or eeriness. And it's very, very effective because that's the main emotions the characters are themselves having. And so I give credit to Phantom Thread in that sense, that if you watch it recently and you were emotionally affected by it, the score was probably carrying most of that weight. It gave the film an emotional punch that it wouldn't be otherwise. And that's mostly because it was able to kind of have this discordant relationship with what you're actually seeing on the screen. Most of the people who listen to that film just through like Spotify or whatever don't really seem to have that same feeling. So I recommend watching that movie again and pay attention to the score. And maybe you'll see why so many people walked away from it and said, oh, wow, this score really had an impact on me, and end up on that list.
All right, so he's talking about the Phantom Thread and how it calls attention to the music more than most films, and maybe that's why it ranked so highly on the Letterboxd ranking thingamabobber. I haven't seen the Phantom Thread yet, which is a pretty big cinematic sin on my part, so I can't really react to that, to the point that he made. And Dane, you haven't either?
Yeah, I haven't seen it either, but it wouldn't surprise me because that's typically the way a Johnny Greenwood score is
used. Is that true? Normally call attention. He calls attention to his music, or the directors call attention to his scores. I thought they were kind of subtle usually.
I think his music pretty much stands out when they use it.
Did he do? I've lost the name of the film. Name some ones that he's done recently that were like Oscar contenders, like recent years.
They often get disqualified.
Oh, they do. So he didn't do the one about the oil baron and the preacher kid and what?
There Will
one.
Be
yeah,
Blood.
Didn't he do that one?
Yes.
Did he get?
Yes.
Didn't it get nominated? I thought that score was nominated.
Yeah, it did.
I don't remember.
It totally did.
But Kristen, you're the only one who's seen The Phantom Thread then, so what do you have to say about Tanner Greer's thoughts regarding The Phantom Thread and why it might have ranked so high?
Well, context is really important when you're talking about film music. And I think my theory for this Letterboxd list was that it was a lot of people who are part of critic circles, and a lot of their nominations are based solely off of the screenings that they see, not based off of any promo CDs or links that they get. So I think since they experience the score solely within the context of the film, that is why it affected them so profoundly, because within the context of the film, it is a very affecting score. So that is why I think it ranks so highly. So essentially, I agree with our caller.
Okay. It doesn't seem like the type of movie that the score would be so affecting. I mean, that you think it's there, like a lot of films and film scores are, but
the score plays a huge role in creating the setting and sort of feeling the dynamic between the two main characters. They end up sort of having this dynamic of dominance and submission, and it's strange and hypnotic.
And the score plays into that?
Yeah.
I mean, the score is beautiful. I love it. And I really did want to see that film, and I just keep not seeing it. But this motivates me. I will make an effort to see it in the next couple of weeks for sure. Okay, well, let's go on. Did you have anything that you wanted to say about it at all, other than what you said, Dane? Just want to make sure.
Oh, no, that's it. I haven't seen it, so okay. I can't offer all of the insight.
So let's listen to the second part of his comment.
Now, my second comment is about Airbender. First off, I want to say, Dane, you need to watch it. Watch it from the beginning, but here's my advice for a lot of people who kind of start watching the first episode or whatever and just really don't get into it. They think it's too childish. The first six episodes are a little silly and a little bit on the childish side, but about episode six, the tone kind of shifts and it becomes a lot more serious and a lot more engaging. I figure that the creators were trying to really figure out who their audience was as in that little time. But that kind of brings up my question for you guys is, who do you think the ideal audience for this Netflix live action series is going to be? This matters because I think it changes maybe the tone and perhaps the score. You know, the difference between there's a tonal difference between Korra and Last Airbender. That's probably due to the fact that Last Airbender people had grown up, you know, had been kids before. Now they're teenagers and it got a lot darker because of that. Well, now those same watchers are now old enough to be having their own children. So who's the audience? Are they the audience? Are the children of today the audience? Is that another kind of teenagers, the group that kind of Korra was aimed at? I'm not really sure. I'm curious what you guys think about this. Do you think it's going to be darker, more mature? Should it be darker, more mature? And if it is darker and more mature, how do you think that will change the score? So I'm really curious on what you guys feel the audience impact will be, like what their potential audience impact might be on the score itself. I also have another question. The original Nickelodeon episodes were, when you take the commercials out, about 22 minutes long. The vast majority of Netflix shows today, they go about 1 hour episodes, and that's with no commercials at all. So that's about, you could fit three of those old episodes into 1 hour today. Is this going to affect the score? Do you score different for a 22-minute episode versus something that's a bit longer? Are there any precedents for this? I can't really think of any, but you guys know this a lot better than me. So I'm really curious if you can think of any episodes where changing the medium from something shorter to something longer or vice versa has significantly changed the way and style of the scoring. And if so, do you think this will be a precedent that, I mean, we might see repeated with the Avatar live action series? Thanks for the show, guys. You're awesome.
Okay, so he's talking about The Last Airbender, the live-action version, which is coming to Netflix soon. He's got a few questions for us on what we think. First, he asks, who do we think the audience is for this? Do we think it's going to be darker, more mature, and how might this affect the score? I'm hoping that the audience is for both young people and adults alike. Don't have to be mutually exclusive. I think the first Avatar, Last Airbender, kind of started off in a more children-y vibe and then became more mature. I think he said that in his comments as well. Became more mature as it went along. Korra was definitely more mature than Last Airbender. So I'm hoping it's both. But maybe I give a slight nod to more mature audiences simply because it's not animated and it's live action. What do you guys think? Who do you think the audience is going
to
be for this?
I would just like to say to Tanner that I have now seen many, many episodes of The Last Airbender, and that I think it's okay, and I like the mythology within it. So I just want to answer that question or that statement that he made.
How many is many, many?
Six. Six episodes.
And out of in one season?
That's correct.
Season one.
That's right.
Okay. It's not enough.
I realize it's not enough. I'm not done with it yet.
It's taking too long. Well, it's okay.
How am I supposed to watch Phantom Thread and all of these other things if I have to stop and watch?
You don't care about Phantom Thread. You would have seen it by now if you cared
I
about it.
I do care Phantom about Thread. Phantom Thread. I just haven't seen it. but I think it will still be geared towards families. I think that's where it's going. I think it'll be like Lost in Space, you know. I think it'll be in that sort of genre or that maturity era.
Hopefully a lot better. That's all. A lot better. What do you think, Kristen? Who's the audience?
I think it's going to be people who watched the initial series, and since they're older now, the families that they have. Yeah. That's
for them and their kids.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I hope that's the think that would have been a wise move for, let's say, Fantastic Beasts, if they had taken that approach, maybe for the adults and their kids. I don't know. That's just me.
I fully agree.
I don't know if you like that series or not, Dane. You weren't really clear. So if you make it a darker, more mature tone, or if it's if the episodes are longer, how do you think that it impacts the score, Dane?
I don't think it. I mean, the form, whether it's short or long, isn't going to change the score, because you don't approach a short film or a long film or an episode any different than you approach anything. It's still a story, so you're still going to score it, you know, story wise. What changes a score is money and audience. So, you know, I think the classic case of that would be like the Clone Wars TV series versus the live action movies, right? They were cartoony. They were still like in that orchestral feel, but they were kind of brighter, a little more actiony, a little more quick, you know? And then they had a different budget for that. So while the Clone Wars film was, all recorded in Prague, you know, the episodes for the show had some live brass and some other live players, but it was a totally different budget. You know, so it depends on, you know, who their audience is. That and the budget, I think, determines.
Just digress real quick. Are you saying, you're talking about that Clone Wars movie that was episodes that were going to air?
Correct. Those came out in the theater first. I don't know if you remember that.
And they had a different budget for that, for the score.
Yeah, yeah, that's all live players.
Okay. I have it. I think I listened to it once, and I haven't listened to it.
Yeah, it's really good. It's really good, yeah. It's all live players. They were all in Prague. But, you know, when they did, you know, specific episodes, depending on the episode, they would hire in live brass and so forth like that. But they didn't, not the whole score was not live.
Gotcha. Well, that's a good comparison then. What do you think about that question, Kristen?
What's the budget?
Hopefully it's as nice as Lost in Space.
I would have to guess it's a pretty good budget, I would think.
Yeah, if I think Netflix, you have correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I think you have a bigger audience, than you would even Lost in Space after all this time.
If it's Netflix, then I'm going to say they'll probably get a budget a la Lost in Space, and they'll probably get some sweet orchestral sessions.
Yeah. The series has such an iconic score to me. It's such a memorable score. Maybe not iconic, but memorable in that, you know, Jeremy Zuckerman had his 3, 4, 5 motifs that he used throughout, and just gotten so used to those, and he's on it, so that's great. And I look forward to hearing him develop those themes more. But I don't think it's going to be vastly different. I would be sad if it was. I mean, you look at the Last Airbender film, and of course, none of his music was used there, but there was like almost nothing in common with the show and the film. But, of course, J&H did an amazing job. There was just nothing musically consistent from the TV show. So it'd be great to hear a full-on, full orchestral version of what Jeremy Zuckerman did for the television show.
Yes.
maybe there's a little less slapstick kind of elements that were in the cartoon. Simply because I mean, like the wah-wahs and those kinds of things. I would be surprised if we get those in a live action. It just might feel a little weird. But you hope they keep them?
I like that.
It would just be weird in a live action show.
It depends on the tone.
When's the last time you heard a wah-wah in a TV show, live action? That wasn't done sarcastically or ironically or, you know, in a self-aware kind of way.
He could find a way.
I'm sure he could. It just doesn't seem like something that's done very often. Okay, well, that's our thoughts on those couple of items. Thank you, Tanner Greer, for taking time to leave us four simultaneous or consecutive, I should say, messages on SpeakPipe Widget. And we hope we answered your question. And we look forward to hearing from you and other listeners with other good comments and questions in the future. Let's move on to our main topic of the night, which is a review of the recently released Ralph Breaks the Internet, which is, i.e., Wreck-It Ralph. And if you don't know, I'll tell you a little bit about the film. Our video game bad guy Ralph and fellow misfit Vanellope von Schweetz must risk it all by traveling to the World Wide Web in search of a replacement part to save Vanellope's video game Sugar Rush. In way over their heads, Ralph and Vanellope rely on the citizens of the internet, the netizens, to help navigate their way, including an entrepreneur named Yes, who is the head of an algorithm and the heart and soul of the trend-making site BuzzTube. Wreck-It Ralph is doing quite well, I guess, at the box office. It's at over $206 million worldwide so far. Had a killer second weekend, over 20-something. Rotten Tomatoes gave it 88 from the critics, 68 from the regular movie-going public. Metacritic has a 71 rating. The soundtrack was released digitally on November 16th, and the physical CD came out on the 30th. Features a song performed by Sarah Silverman, Gal Gadot, and has music composed by Alan Menken. Has an original end credit song by Imagine Dragons. And, of course, the score was written by Henry. Guys, what did you think of Wreck-It Ralph back in 2000? What was that, 12? Wasn't that long ago. 14? I should have written the date down. What did you think of the original Wreck-It Ralph and its score?
I loved it.
Both?
Yes. I thought the movie was delightful, the original one. And the score... I don't know, it kind of pushed me into a very optimistic about Henry Jackman phase.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it is a regular player on my workout playlist, and like I still listen to it.
Wow. That's high praise.
Yeah. Yeah. I like it an awful lot.
Okay. Wow. I've never heard you bring it up when we get into Henry Jackman. Or do you? And I just don't remember.
I feel like I do every single does. Time.
I feel like she does, too.
Okay. I don't remember. Okay. What did you think, Dane?
Oh, I liked the original. Absolutely. Loved it. And I thought it was the first film where I recall thinking, oh, awesome, they're bringing back the 80s synths. I mean, like, everything about it was hysterically funny, and the way he scored it with his synths was fantastic. It's great, great stuff.
Okay.
Great stuff.
All right. Yeah, I enjoyed it as well. I wasn't over the moon about it, but I enjoyed it, and I thought the score fit really well. I think I listened to it quite a bit that year or that end of year, but it's since kind of faded out into distant memory. I haven't listened to that in quite some time until coming back to kind of listen to it for this particular review as we got into the sequel of it. So I guess we're all coming from a fairly positive place from both the film and the score. So let's talk about then our reaction to this film in general with no spoilers. I'll just say I thought it started really, really slow. I enjoyed the messages of the film. I just said the story that was used to tell to present those messages weren't executed as well as it was in the first film. And so in overall, I didn't enjoy the film as much as the first one. It felt a little too much going on, and they just didn't quite pull all that off too well. And I have a confession to make, too. I think I have a problem. I'm calling it cinematic narcolepsy.
Are you turning into my mother?
I'm turning into somebody's mother. I get sleepy in these movies. I was there at a 4:15 showing. And I got so, you know, it might be these chairs are so comfortable now, I recline and everything, but I dozed off in this one too. I was so drowsy watching it, and it's happening with great regularity now, so I may have a problem.
you don't have a problem.
If a movie is over 90 minutes, she is out.
No, it's not the length. I'm like, By the time they got to the internet, I was really sleepy. Mm. And somewhere in there, I dozed off. Oh.
I did too. Terrible first act will do it to you.
What will? What'd you say will do it?
A terrible first act will do that to you.
Maybe that's the case because, let's see, Rogue One. What else did I fall asleep in? I didn't fall asleep in The Last Jedi because I was too mad to fall asleep. Fantastic Beasts. Just this new one fell asleep in. I know there's been more. Anyway, I think I have a problem. I'm going to start a group called Cinematic Narcoleptics and see who else joins. Dane, did you say you just fell asleep too?
Yeah, I did, actually. We went and got our Christmas tree, which I then carried up three flights of stairs and then ran out the door with the two boys. And we went to the theater, which is right across the street. We sat down and I got the popcorn, they got grilled cheese. We were sitting there enjoying ourselves. Movie started. I was like psyched to see it. I got about, I don't know, halfway through the middle and I was like, gone.
So what was your reaction in general to the film outside of falling asleep like me?
I mean, it wasn't bad. I liked the opening. And I liked the end. I think the middle got long and complicated, which is probably why I fell asleep, because there was like too much going on and my brain was like, shut down. it really lost me at the climax. Like as it built up to the climax, I was kind of like, yeah, get it over with. Come on, let's do it, you know. But then it won me back at the end with all the heart and I cried.
Wow. All right, Kristen, what was your reaction to the film? Did you fall asleep?
No,
would you like to be in cinematic narcoleptics?
I would prefer to be, because this was a mess. this was such a mess. Like, I can't believe I'm the grouch this episode. I'm Justin.
Someone's got to be. It's usually me.
Yeah, the beginning was weak. It was completely paint by numbers. And then the middle was like this amorphous plot jelly. And the ending was lame. And it was like they had a million concepts, all of which they had to pass the committee of sponsors. And they needed to jam every single one of these concepts mm-hmm. into the movie.
She's talking about Fantastic Beasts, I just want to say. She's not talking about this movie.
I'm talking about this movie. I didn't even see Fantastic Beasts.
It's just like this.
No, not okay. A fan. Not a fan. I'm so disappointed because the first movie was so focused on having these delightful characters and building a story around that. And this one was just a bunch of junk thrown into a script. And spat out into like what AOL's vision of the internet from the 1990s was.
I think there was a little more to it, but we can get to that in spoilers.
oh, there was more to it, a lot more to it, a lot more that was just like completely unedited, except by the sponsors. You couldn't have anything criticizing Google or the actual evil that can be done by, you know. But I digress.
All right, let's react to the score then. Did you like the score more than you liked the film? Is it going to be on your exercise playlist, Kristen?
It probably will be. I mean, I loved the expansion off the first, although there was a shocking number of lifts from The Matrix. Don Davis horns everywhere.
Pick that up.
I listened to it again today, and I don't get it either. I mean, I can see where you're thinking it's coming from, but like I don't hear the
reflective. Well, that's what I'm thinking of when I hear Dante. I don't hear it. You have to.
I mean, I kind of heard it, like you
I
said.
Hear it in
you have to point out some
tracks
so we can go listen to them.
I think it's because your left ear is blocked by fluid at the moment.
No, it's my right ear.
I'm sorry. I think it's because your right ear is blocked by fluid at the moment.
Note to the listeners, I truly am half deaf right now, so he's not just slamming me.
Okay, so we'll have to do some more listening to find those Don Davis horns. There's obviously brass all over it, but when I saw you say that on Twitter, I was like, huh? I must have missed something, but I don't hear that part. But so you like it in general?
I heard it in the theater, then I heard it again when I listened to the soundtrack. So I'm like, I'm not going crazy. And then at a point, my husband was like, you know, this part in the end credits sounds really familiar. And I go, it's The Matrix. He goes, oh my God, yeah.
That's so wild. I don't hear that.
I mean, he's a muggle, so.
He's a soundtrack muggle. What about you, Dane? What was your reaction to the score?
I liked it. I mean, I thought it was a typical animation score, so it wasn't, it Mickey Moused at the right times. It did all the stuff it was supposed to do. But where it really shines, just like the first one, is in Jackman's synth work. You know, I love it. Every time the synths come in, I'm like, yes, yeah. This is cool. He doesn't abuse them. He doesn't flaunt them. They fit, right? They're just right
this
there.
This is the perfect showcase for that.
Yeah. And he does a great job of bringing in the chip tunes, bringing in the synths, and bringing in, you know, I love from the first one and in this one, I really love the world in the Surge Protector. You know, from the you got Qbert walking by in the first one, and then you had all the characters in this one. I just love that. I love that world. I think it's great, and he does a great job of scoring it. Yeah, I know, right?
So many great little characters. Well, let's talk about some standout tracks from the soundtrack. There's a number of them. I think, Dane, give us yours.
I liked Best Friends because it took you right into the movie and reminded me of why I liked the first one.
Mm-hmm. Now, that has the main theme, right?
Yep.
Ralph's theme. Okay.
Yep. Mm-hmm. I love that. And then I loved Shank. I was like, when that started in the movie, and then as I've listened to it later, I was like, this might be my favorite track on this album.
Interesting.
Yeah, I love all the funkiness to it. Mm-hmm. And he also got close to disco a couple of times, which I thought was pretty fun, like in Overnight Sensation. But I liked Shank a lot. And then I like A Big Strong Man in Need of Rescuing, because I just think his weaving of all of those Princess themes together was absolutely phenomenal.
Yep.
And then I liked the emotional pieces, like Letting
At the
Go.
End, yeah.
Yeah, and Worlds Apart. I thought those were really, really beautiful. And then the song. The song is awesome.
Yeah, there's a couple of songs a couple of the songs I actually liked. When you say the song, you're talking about A Place Called Slaughter Race.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And the way the princess element built that up to create that moment was beautiful. Like, you just stare at water and then you start to sing. And then I just thought that was awesome.
Yeah, I really like that song a lot. I mean, to me, that's the standout thing from the whole soundtrack, really. Because it's so, I mean, it's perfect Alan Menken. You know, it's quintessential Alan Menken. And it's just great. And it's just like, man, I wish there was more of that. Now, when I listened to the Beauty and the Beast soundtrack, the new one, I didn't like the new songs. They didn't have the same kind of, I don't know, cleverness or verve like this does for some reason. It's kind of weird to me. What do you think of this song, Kristen?
I loved it. It was definitely a high point for me. Alan Menken, when Alan Menken kind of lampoons Alan Menken,
yeah,
it's something great. Like, he did it for Gallivant too.
Okay, I'm not listening to much of that.
Yeah. As Dane said, the setup was great. You know, you just look into some water, but meaningful water. And she's like looking into like a spilled cup of water. Yeah. And yeah. It's like this sort of bizarro princess world for her, where everything's kind of broken, kind of wrong.
Right.
But it fits with her because she's the glitch. And
what she wants is completely different from all the other, you know, she wants this horrible place called Slaughter Race.
I think you mean totally awesome place called Slaughter Race.
I guess. But comparatively speaking to the things that the other princesses wanted. The only thing that bothered me at certain notes was Vanellope's voice. I mean, obviously that's her voice and that's what she's supposed to sound like. But sometimes a couple of notes that, you know, they really, okay, get that gritty, grindy, raspy, and I was just like, oh, it's so painful.
Sarah it's such a Silverman's nice not, you know, a vocalist.
No, but she did fine throughout most of that song. I don't know if that's her through the whole thing, but when they really had her lean into that gravelly, I was like, oh, it's just really, really off-putting. But that's who she is as a character, so I get it. It just was off-putting. What are yours, Kristen?
My list is so small.
We've kind of talked about it.
Well, Dane said Best Friends, which I also really enjoyed. That really kind of brings you into the original thematic material. So I really liked that. I also liked The Internet, Don Davis and all. I mean, in the movie, they even had them enter the internet in the form of a red pill and a blue pill.
I thought that's a good point.
Pointing that out was a great point. That you're so right.
So,
but I didn't hear Don Davis there at all.
I don't.
And I like that. I like that track a lot.
It's there. I swear. I feel like Charlie from It's Always Sunny with the wall and the everything's connected. It's Don Davis is in there. This isn't a conspiracy.
I guess it makes sense. I just totally I missed it.
Anyway, aside from that, I really liked Jackman's sonic take on the internet, where he still was doing the synth thing, but it's just so much more shiny.
Hmm. Yeah.
If you know what I mean. Yeah.
Yes.
So it's a similar aesthetic to being in the Surge, but it's sleeker. I liked that an awful lot. I also really liked the search bar. I thought that was a cute bit.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
The pop-up stuff. I liked his work with the pop-ups. I also thought that was very cute.
I don't remember. What did he do specifically for those?
It was kind of jaunty.
Okay. Do you remember what track that's in?
It is, God, I wish I wrote it down this time. Get Rich Quick.
Okay. That one didn't, I didn't jot that one down. I have to go back and listen to that one.
Yeah.
I did think it was funny when they had that person that came by and told Ralph, what was it, a bunch of ladies from wherever wanted to meet him, and he's like, they do? Remember that? I was like, I couldn't believe that was in there, but it was a good stab for all the adults.
For sure. I have a few as well. I like Circuit Breaker. It's pretty chaotic. There's one bit in there that I don't know what the time signature is, but it's really odd, and it feels kind of Christoph Beckish, Ant-Man-ish, kind of propulsive kind of feel to it. I love it when he changes up his tempos and his time signatures within, and that one has a lot of that. You mentioned the internet. I like that. To me, it's just a heroic fanfare. I need to go back and hear the Don Davis-ness of it.
I swear to God.
Okay. Sightseeing. It's very Homecoming-like, and once the one track came out that had the Star Wars bits in it, and I heard this one, I was like, man, that really sounds like Spider-Man Homecoming. It's very close, but it's not. Mm. I was hoping for a Spider-Man cameo. No Spider-Man cameo.
But Stan Lee.
Yes.
True.
Yes, Stan Lee. I loved that.
True. Very true. I liked Hanging Out. It's a very short track, but it's got that kind of Bay, Oakland Bay funk kind of style, which I like. I wish that piece was longer. I love the title for Kling Kong. I mean, I thought that was really, really clever. And I liked that part, that message they were trying to convey, although it was, I don't think they executed it great. I mean, they got the point across for sure. But I like the title, Kling Kong. And I think we talked about all the other ones. Let's kind of start wrapping it up. Of course, Vanellope's March kind of hit first. What'd you guys think of that? I mean, kind of hit the internet, our internet, before the movie came out, and was a little bit a buzz about it. And then you saw it in the film. What did you think? Kind of like, eh, okay, or what?
It's cute. It's not very much.
Yeah.
But it's cute.
Yeah. It is at least cute.
Sorry.
I like how it goes from the Imperial March to actually a bit from like A New Hope. And that's a really great transition. Mm-hmm. And that he was able to use... it's just great that he was able to use so many pieces of music from all these different properties. And not just things that kind of sound similar to them.
Which could be why, to go back to Kristen's point about, oh, the whole Disney thing, how's that related to the internet, blah, blah, blah. Well, it was a lot easier to grab all of these franchises that they own and use all the stuff from there than to try and license from everything.
Yeah, why would you need sources. To? They have plenty to choose from.
I really liked how he subtly in the Vanellope's March kind of made hints towards Heartbeeps, John Williams' Heartbeeps, because that's the kissing cousin of the Imperial March with synths, and so he kind of has that in here too a little bit, which I thought was a ironic, funny thing.
I
to
didn't
me,
pick
anyway.
Up on that. Interesting. Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, that little synth that's going on in the background. Yeah, it's if you go listen to the original or the score for Heartbeeps, you hear that same little thing on in the background too. So I thought it was cool.
All right,
that was cool.
Well, those are our thoughts. Any final thoughts about the score of the film? Do you think there'll be a Wreck-It Ralph 3? Ralph.
It's been doing so well. I couldn't imagine.
Ralph fixes the internet.
How are they going to do a third one? I mean, where's the story?
I don't know. I didn't
Where
see this
story
coming.
Where was the story for this one?
Yeah,
well,
this
they at
was
least
kind
have a concept. Like you can go to internet. What are they gonna wreck now? I mean, what is he gonna do? You know, where are they gonna go? They break into people's VR goggles.
VR.
I mean,
Ralph
yeah.
breaks VR.
Ralph hacks the Pentagon.
I think that's been done before, frankly.
The internet's a big place.
Nobody come after me. I can't do that.
The internet, I don't know. I don't know where they would go. I'm sure they can come up with something. But I don't. This whole construct was, you know, kind of, it wasn't executed with much elegance. It was just, no. We got to get them on the internet. You know, well, let's get them in, and they can have adventures on the internet. So maybe they go mobile.
On the internet. We're going to reference Disney and Google and YouTube and BuzzFeed and eBay and, you know,
They did miss out by having them jump from mobile device to mobile, like a big chase that went from like phones to iPads to, you know, whatever. They're like running along. People are like, what's happening? And then they go singing along or something. That would have been fantastic. They could have done something like that.
You know, that you just, when you said that just now, Kristen, that kind of, I think that hits on a point that maybe makes me like this less, partly why I like it less than the first one, is because the first one was dealing with existing IPs, but they were kind of just subtly, the characters from those old games were kind of mixed in, and this was so much in your face, big corporate everything.
Yeah, and you know they probably had to pass every single joke by a committee from each of those brands that they showed on screen. The whole thing, I feel very cynical about the whole thing, and that's not a great feeling for a franchise where I really loved the first movie that created such, you know, a warm feeling of nostalgia. And now I'm just like, ugh, like this sort of drives home how crass everything is now. It's like reverse nostalgia for me.
Yeah, in fact, you know, it's a good point. You know, Chris, earlier you mentioned about the comments that you've been reading about the podcast or whatever. But they hinted at it, but they didn't really talk about when he goes to read the comments on the videos of him, and he's brokenhearted. And that is one aspect of the internet and how we are today that is lost. You know, like it has brought a lot of crap.
I'm glad they dealt with it.
They were kind of dealing with it, but they didn't really deal with it, where like he's broken by all of that, you know. And
it's kind of the thing that gets his insecurities going again.
Yeah, it is. You're right.
It's opens that whole thing up, you know, for the end of the movie is his insecurity. I mean, I think they could have maybe done a better job of it, but they did. They dealt with it pretty much head on, you know.
I think one thing that was interesting in our viewing, and this is the other cool thing about our theater, Chris, before every movie, they show you little clips of other things that relate to what you're about to watch. And for this one, they kept showing these 90s infomercials about the internet with kids. And after I started watching the movie, I was like, they picked the perfect little clips to put before this, because when you go back and remember how everybody felt about the internet, you kind of realize that Kristen's point that it was like how AOL visioned the internet. That's what this was, right? It was a 90s envisionment of the internet, not the reality that we have today.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. You know what? I was thinking it'd have been great if the big bad in this film had been like the comments manifesting into something and that becomes the bad guy. That would have been kind of cool instead of this rogue virus thing.
That comes out of nowhere at the end of the second act, and all of a sudden you realize that the antagonist is the insecurities of Ralph Lake. God.
Hey, now there is your Matrix connection. That virus looked just like the bad guys in the Matrix.
Yeah, it kind of looked like the squiddies or whatever they called
them. Yeah.
Kind of. All right. Well, that was a good discussion about a mediocre movie. Mediocre, good, bad.
Burgeoning screenwriters, do not use this as a model of a script. This is not how you write a script.
But in terms of the score, I think we agree Andrew Jackman did a fairly solid job
Yes.
Decent job.
Score. Totally agree.
And Alan Menken's totally contribution was substantial and much appreciated.
Very much so.
A delight.
Hopefully, Aladdin will have equally good additions, I hope. But I don't know. But we can hope. All right. Dane, where can people find and follow you on the internet?
On Twitter, the little place with the little birds that tweet. You can find me at Maestro Dane. On YouTube, Dane Walker Music. My website is danewalkermusic.com. As I've said before, put Dane with Walker and music, and you can find me.
Kristen, how can people find and follow you?
The easiest way to find me is on Twitter at KBForNow. That's KBFORNOW. You can find FilmScore Monthly online at FSMOnlineMag.com. Also on Twitter at FSMOnlineMag. We just put out the November issue. We have... What do we have on the cover? We have a great cover.
TBD. It's going to be great.
I was sick for 2 weeks. I was sick while we were putting this together.
You mentioned it.
Oh, my God. I am the worst. Load website. Load. Oh, yeah. Sans Zimmer. Top scores by remote control composers not named Hans.
Okay. We'll be looking for Song Zimmer.
Yeah.
You can find and follow me on the internet personally at C. Coleman. That's on Twitter. Find and follow the show on Twitter at Audio Soundcast. Or if you want to find all the soundtrackiness on Twitter that I can muster, that's at Track Sounds. We'd like to know what you thought of Ralph and Henry Jackman's score. Please let us know by shooting us an email at soundcast@tracksounds.com, or like our friend Tanner Greer did, leave us a message on our SpeakPipe widget on the site, soundcast.com, or find us on Facebook and leave it there. That's going to do it for episode 123 of Soundcast. Thank you all for listening. Until our next episode, we want to say may the notes be with you. Is there anything about the film you want to talk about, spoiler-wise? It doesn't seem like it's... I mean, what's there to spoil, really, in this one? It's not like any...
There is no AOL in this internet?
Nor should there be.
You could spoil that. The whole thing is AOL. Look. When I was in the ninth grade, I was taking a computer class in my Catholic school, and it was taught by a nun, and we had a textbook that explained what the World Wide Web was to us. And they had an illustration that looked like the concept of what this world was. And yeah.
I thought they did I honestly thought they did a great job of showing how the internet works. What it really is conceptually, right?
I mean,
no, I liked it. My kids were like, oh, so there's a signal that goes to the Wi-Fi router that then goes through the phone lines, and then it becomes this thing. Like, they totally got it in a unique way.
They did that right.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Like, yeah, that's the part that was like, oh.
You don't get to that through the surge protector.
No, I know. Don't ruin it, Chris. Don't ruin it. I mean, we got to suspend our belief about something.
I didn't make the movie. They made the movie. Actually, you can, in the old days, you could put your modem...
In your surge protector.
Your RJ45 into your surge protector, but that's not what they're using, unfortunately.
Thank Christ they found a pornless internet.
Wreck-It Ralph 3. Porn cops.
Oh, my goodness.
Ralph wrecks the porn cops.
Off Ralph, air inside jokes.
Ralph is a porn cop. How about that?
Oh my
Ralph
goodness.
Becomes a porn cop.
I thought they did that really well.
It was okay.
I thought
I thought BuzzTube was a little weak. They couldn't just call out one or the other.
Yes. Yes, and trending videos don't work that way.
Right.
Look, that's like a nitpick. Yeah. That wasn't even what I had trouble with.
Okay.
But I feel like the best ideas and jokes for this are all watchable on YouTube right now. That, like the princess stuff, that's all in the trailer.
Mm-hmm. Most of it.
No, it wasn't all.
Most of it.
I mean, when they rescued him at the end, that was freaking brilliant.
It was good.
Was it brilliant, though?
It was good.
It was. Like, how they incorporated all of them, and then Jackman scored each one of them, and, like, to get that all together, I thought that was fantastic. And then he ended up in Snow White's dress. I thought that was hysterical.
That was kind of weird. I don't know why they had to do that.
Jackman arranged themes for each one.
Yeah, but the fact that he could, in an action sequence, mold all those together perfectly.
Yeah.
That was brilliant.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but it's brilliant.
I liked it.
Okay.
I liked it. I liked when I recognized it.
I liked the princesses, but the whole thing was, it was extended commercial. Everything they were wearing, the comfy princess clothes, so cute. Those can all be bought on Disney's website.
But they didn't say it in the movie. I didn't.
They didn't say in the movie, but
you looked it up.
No, I didn't. I've seen them.
Oh, okay.
Well, I was like, I've seen that Nap Queen t-shirt because I sleep all the time.
you go over to the Arsenal Mall and you see all the moms walking around in those clothes, don't you, Kristen?
Right.
Well, hey, if you're going to put them in
like
casual
a
clothes,
stream in and out of Marshalls.
Why not put them in their own casual clothes? That makes sense.
So, like this whole thing just made me even more communist than I already am.
Well, I mean, we are dealing with the uber ultra company the world.
I know, which is what kind of made me even more disgusted by taking this, you know, sort of cute nostalgic thing and then putting it into sort of the grotesqueness of what gaming and the internet is now. It's sullied the whole thing.
You know, that's a question I have, and maybe I slept through the explanation. What do they have to do with the internet? What do the princesses
have to do?
With the internet,
the princesses.
Yeah, why are they there together in the internet in a room? What is that? Where were they? Why were they there?
Because Disney is on the internet, and they found them because Vanellope wanted to be a pop-up ad, so she was sent into the internet with a pop-up ad, and initially she was going to be sent to Slaughter Race, and Ralph was like, no, 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 she's a princess. We have to find someplace nice for her. She's just a little girl. And yes, the algorithm was like, okay, we'll find a kid's place for her and sent her to like Disney.
Gotcha.
Whatever.
Gotcha.
And I want to say that I thought they missed a great opportunity to make fun of themselves because it should have been Disney.go.com.
That's true.
Why do they still do that?
Because they bought Go.com and they own it.
Like,
and that was supposed to be
1996.
Yes. Yes. And that was supposed to be their like internet thing. They were going to be like internet kings with that. And
but
it
why
bombed.
Are you holding it onto it? Like,
it's
after
a great domain.
Years.
I wish I could have Go.com.
20 years.
It's ESPN.go.com, Disney.go.com.
ABC.go.com.
Yeah, it's a great domain, but I wouldn't be using it like that. So what is this about the pancake bunny and the exploding baby? I've slept through this too, clearly.
That was at the end.
So the first post-credits.
Oh, that one. Oh, yes. Okay.
Yeah. So, and it's a recycled Monty Python joke.
It is.
So, oh yeah, it's out of Meaning of Life. And so basically, you know, it's the kids playing this pancake feeding to a bunny and Milkshake goes to the kitty game. Yeah. And Ralph comes in.
Yeah, I did see this
pancake,
part.
Pancake, 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 pancake. And the bunny gets, you know, all swelled up and gigantic, and he shoves one more pancake into the bunny and the bunny explodes and the baby screams. Yeah. And I thought it was hilarious. That was the best part of the movie for me. But it was a recycled Monty Python joke. It was the same thing from Meaning of Life, where the guy eats so much in the restaurant and the maitre d' comes up and goes, "Would you like an after dinner, mitt? It's wafer thin." And he has that and it explodes.
I didn't make that connection. I didn't think that was all that funny. Anyway, that part. I was like, okay.
I think after me just not liking this movie at all, just having the comfort of Monty Python in like a bunny eating pancakes context, traumatizing a child.
Now, is that a real game?
Like, perfect for me.
It looks like a game that would exist, but I've never heard of it. What about you?
It looks cute.
That for sure. Dane, anything on the film, spoiler-wise, you wanted to mention?
Oh, I love the Disney princess stuff. I thought that was the best part of the film, frankly. I thought it was hysterically funny. I did not like how they treated Star Wars characters. I felt that that was...
Other than 3PO popping his head in, I must have slept through something else. What else did they do? And the stormtroopers.
Oh, just, you know, R2-D2 was just like bumped, and the stormtroopers were like, you know, all the kids loved it. My kids were just, you know, laughing at it all. But I was just like, you know, why do the stormtroopers have to be stupid all the time now? Why can't they still be scary like in 1977, 78, whenever that was? Anyway, I like that. And then in terms of the plot, I thought it was kind of a beautiful dad-daughter story.
But are they dad-daughter?
They're not, but that's what I saw in it. Of course, I am a dad with a daughter who is hitting the teen years.
I mean, they're friends, right? But she seems like a little teen, like a little girl, even though she...
I know, but they're also, let's remember, zeros and ones, as they tell us.
Yeah. I'm just talking about their relationship is, you know, the way she looks and sounds and acts a little, like a little girl sometimes, but then she acts more mature than him sometimes. It's just kind of weird.
Right.
The relationship's kind of weird.
Yeah, but I saw it reflected as a father-daughter sort of story, like, you know.
Why is she a princess?
I cried at the end. I felt Ralph's pain.
How is she a princess?
That was established.
I don't remember that
first movie. She was like so within Sugar Rush, I think there was the Candy King, and she was supposed to be the actual royal lion.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah. Okay. All right. I just needed some dots connected because I'm like, how are you a princess? Because I liked that a lot. I liked that. I liked having all the princesses together. It sounded like they got most of the original voice actors back, not all. Obviously, for older Cinderella, Snow White, they couldn't have that. But for some of the newer ones, it seems like they got most of them, which was great. What I do not want to have happen, as popular as the princesses were in this thing, and my favorite part, is I do not want to see a feature film or franchise come, you know, the princesses 1, 2, and 87. I don't want to see a television series, which they probably put on their...
Good. You'll enjoy the YouTube series they're going to do.
That's fine.
No, I'm just kidding.
I don't want it to exist. Now, shorts, maybe, where you have a clever little concept, a clever little scenario where maybe not all of them, but you get a handful of them and you have something clever and you do that, maybe. But please don't ruin this. And I mean, I think it can be special if it stays in this film. But I think it's going to be the most popular part of the film. And I think it's going to become something. But it would just be sad.
I loved Merida being unintelligible.
She's from that other studio.
Now, did they use her theme in that They played some music, but I didn't recognize it at all in the action, kind of the conclusion.
Oh, maybe I'm. I thought it was clearly
Irish. Are they Irish or Scottish? They're Scottish, right? Aren't they Scottish?
They're Scottish, yeah. You can check the.
The credits will say, won't
the
they?
The credits. Yeah, the credits will have it licensed because I noticed like a list of all the other ones. I don't remember whether Brave was on there.
They definitely had some Scottish music, but nothing. It didn't ring a bell. Okay.